This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
A message from a former New Yorker, presented by Street Easy.
We left Brooklyn Heights in 2021, and we miss it. We went from sharing a neighborhood with a few celebrities to sharing a neighborhood with my wife's parents.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Well, welcome back to another edition of Off the Air with Ben and Woods. We've got a very special guest joining us today, San Diego native and CBS chief Washington correspondent Major Garrett. Did I get that right?
That's right.
This is weird. I feel really weird. Me sitting here and him sitting there. Mm. He should be sitting here and I should be sitting there. This is what you do.
Sort of.
Well, yeah. You do this very well. You are a true professional. I am, as I'm told almost every day on Twitter, a hack.
What? I'm told I'm a hack too.
Trust me. Holy shit. It is it's getting spicy towards the end of the year, and you're a huge Padres fan. Yep. I love your takes on the team. I want to talk we don't talk a lot of baseball in this show, but I want to talk just a little bit about some baseball because we have Major Garrett here. And of course we got Paulie Reindl. Hello, Paulie.
Hey, how we doing?
Looking sharp. Benjamin Higgins joins us as well. Benjamin. How are you?
We call you Benjamin on the show.
I love this role that I get at the end of the couch side. Let Woods do the heavy lifting. I'll just chime in when necessary.
I do. I watched a David Letterman special recently with Howard Stern on Netflix. It's an old one. It's maybe 5, 6, 7 years old. It's
my next guest.
Yeah, my next guest. And I thought to myself, that's what I should have done. That's what I didn't think was possible, is to do one of these, you know,
to be David Letterman.
Yeah. I mean, shoot for the stars, right? If you're going to do it. But I just remember growing up loving that man so much.
Letterman.
His very sarcastic
top 10 list
were fine, but for me it was the banter. You know, it was the banter with the guest. It's sarcastic, sardonic. It was all of it, and I just loved it. I just
like a warm blanket at night.
Yeah and really he was fearless. That's what I admired about him the most. He was fearless. He was also a psychopath.
The news and entertainment divisions are different, but did you get to cross paths with David Letterman at all?
No, unfortunately. And the lines of division are such that I never crossed paths outside of the one time I was on Colbert. My book had come out about the Trump administration, so they had me on. Supposed to be one segment. I earned two.
That's
so
amazing.
That was fun. That was cool.
I did not know you were on Colbert.
Yeah, I was.
I didn't do any show research for this show, which would make me, you know, that's probably would have been my downfall as a late night TV host.
Funny story. Well, it was to me, at least. So you're back and you're waiting to be introduced, and there's this walk that you have to make. And I started to think to myself, what am I going to do? What is my body? How am I going to present? You can't go out mousy or...
No, what does my gait look like as I walk out to the stage? Do I give the crowd
And I'm like, I can't do that. Yeah. I can't be like Gladiator or something.
You don't want to be like Hitler.
You know...
I won't do it, but everybody does it now.
Ladies and gentlemen, Major Garrett. Right. Man, thank you very much, Major Garrett. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And I did want to do the phony political thing, which is you're up on stage, you point to someone like you do this. And I did. I said, well, what am I going to do?
That's panic-inducing.
So if you go back and look at the clip, I just walk and I just start clapping my hands.
Oh, yeah. Just
It's like a maniac. Clapping my hands. Okay. All right. Oh, there. Oh, there's Colbert. I better stop clapping my hands. Okay.
Mike Schilt cheering for a good sacrifice bunt over here.
It's really, you don't think about that probably until you're right
until
there.
They're like, what am I going to do?
I admire you a lot. We all do. And, you know, I was just talking about Letterman and the fearless people. Mm-hmm. Fearless. I would say we operate in this job with I would say more fear than I used to. You get a little bit older.
Sure.
You get a little bit wiser. I think there's some wisdom in not being so brazen, so trying to shock, so performative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of, you're in politics. The performative aspect is bananas. And it's really bothered me the last few years in sports radio of the, how dare Mike Schilt go to David Morgan when he should have, like,
right.
It's so beyond fucking exhausting that I can't stand it anymore. And when I did it. And then when I see people do it, and there's a lot of them.
It's purely performative. It's purely you're pandering performative. To the people in your chat, because that's what they want.
And I pander like a motherfucker, right. But I don't pander like that anymore.
But nothing's going to be accomplished from whoever doing that.
Right.
Like, that's not, Mike Schilt's not going to see that and be like, son of a bitch, he's right.
He's right.
Right. It's the certainty of irresponsibility.
Yes.
You're not responsible for anything in this medium.
Correct. Nothing.
Except ratings.
Correct.
And you know that there is a path to ratings being certain in your irresponsibility. A major league manager, general manager, doesn't have that luxury. This responsibility stalks them every single day.
Yeah, every minute of the day.
Every minute. And they know they're going to be scrutinized externally, internally, and criticized, because nothing you can do escapes some criticism. Everything will be criticized.
Well, there's never been a team that's gone 162-0. No. There never will be.
No.
There never will be. And that is...
And that's why I admire people who are in the arena, who weather the storms, because they're storms that I don't know anything about.
Correct.
I don't know what it's like to give up a home run as a closer and lose a game and have to walk off the mound and stare at 40,000 people whom you've just pissed off.
Yeah.
And let all your teammates down, yeah. Which is even worse.
Yeah. Is there a worse job than that?
Going into the clubhouse and like, dudes, I just blew the game.
All your hard work to get that lead for me.
You went 3-for-3. You went 4-for-4. And
you
went
7 innings.
Yeah. And I blew it.
Busted your ass.
And that's a kind of pressure and accountability I've never had to live with. Now, yeah. I've had to live with lots of other accountability, and I welcome it, because journalism is something that the public has a right to scrutinize. Everyone in the political arena scrutinizes every reporter, and I've held up well.
Yep.
I've held up well. I've borne that scrutiny and taken that pressure because I asked for it. It's something I uniquely asked for. And when you ask a president of the United States a question and the president of the United States barks back at you, you're in the middle of it.
Yeah. Fuck.
You are in the middle of it. And that give and take is part of what makes our country strong.
Yeah.
Parts of what make the presidency strong. Parts of what make a free press accountable and strong. I've always believed in it. I've always tried to operate at the highest level. And that's the kind of pressure I've brought on myself. But it's unique and different than any of the pressure in the sports world. And I admire the people who can handle that pressure more than the people can handle in my world, because I think that's tougher.
It's interesting. I think we all take pride in what we do, but ultimately, if we feel like we had a bad show, we didn't entertain quite as many people that day. If the Padres have a bad game or a bad season, they disappoint an entire city. But you know, Major, I feel like in your role, there have been journalists, interviewers who have changed the course of history.
Yes.
So
yes.
I feel like
I have not. Let's be clear.
But you could at any moment, at any day. You know, there could be the next story, the next interview, and you have to have that responsibility on your shoulders, knowing that, you know, this is something that has happened before, and you do have to carry that weight, and I think you carry it remarkably well.
Thank you. I mean, I will say this. There's a very famous episode involving myself and President Obama over the Iran nuclear deal and a very big press conference he had in the East Room of the White House. And I asked a very tough question. President came at me really hard. I had a feeling he was going to come at me really hard. And when the president comes at you hard, you take it. My job is to ask the question. Whatever the president, any president does with that question is entirely up to the president.
That's it. That's it. That's it right there. What he just said. And that sums up what we go through every other week when we interview Mike Schilt. All I can do is ask the guy the question. That's it.
Right.
What he chooses to answer, that's not on me. Nope. It's on him.
Right.
And we're at the point now in the season where if the team loses a game, our Twitter blows up with, hey, maybe you ask him about this next time, you fucking pussies. And it's like,
yeah, in 11 days,
in
by
11
the way.
Days, I'll ask him why he went Jeremiah Estrada against the Dodgers. And it's fucking pointless and fruitless. But we are now at the point of the season where, like last night, guy, you know, hey, don't take it easy on Schilt the next time. And it's like, all right, man, I DM the guy. I go, I don't understand your comment. I go, I get him as I try to get to Mike Schilt and get the questions because the responsibility, Ben, whilst it's not as great as it is in Washington, a guy wrote me last week and was like, hey, man, you guys are the conduit to the manager. Sometimes the manager doesn't understand that per se, but we are the conduit. We are the voice of the fan. And so when people, you know, in the organization have before, like, oh, you're just asking questions off Padres Twitter. And I go, yeah, exactly. Those are your customers. That's exactly what I'm doing. Right. This is what they want to know about.
Right.
I know you want to me to blow you for 10 minutes, but I'm not going to. I can't. Used to, I would. I'd be like, oh, man, team's playing great. 17 games over 500. Talk about how great that is, right? And I've realized over the years there is a responsibility that we have to be the voice of the fan. But you, what they don't understand is you also have to be respectful. When you ask the president a question, you can't be like, you fucking idiot, blah, 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 blah. How dare you do this?
No.
There's an art form to it. I have not even come close to mastering it. My questions ramble on too long. I give him too many outs. There's no question. I go back and listen. And I go, you fucked that up. But I'm getting better and better as the years go by. But that is the hardest part of the job for me is the when the team's going poorly, let's yell at Ben and Woods because they're semi-positive about the team. It's the worst part of the gig. It's probably what's going to run me out.
So two quick observations. First, I have never done an interview, never, on the other side of which I didn't say, I screwed that up. I left a question on the table. I blew a follow-up. Why didn't you follow up there?
Yeah, push.
How could you forget that other thing? So I've never had an interview that I've been satisfied with. Never. Back to the encounter with President Obama. I didn't change the world, but I changed the world for some very important people. At the time, there were several Americans in Iranian custody. One of them was Jason Rezaian, correspondent and columnist for the Washington Post. And this blow-up was the president thinking I was accusing him of ignoring the fate of the Americans. I didn't. He thought I was pretty close to it, dangerously close, and he wanted to make sure politically and otherwise no one got the impression he was indifferent or not working hard on this.
Right. Real quick,
to a certain degree, though, even if you didn't mean it that way, if that's how it was interpreted, then that's what you did.
Right.
You know what I mean? In a sense, like if that's how he took it, then that's going to be, there's a little bit of perception. You're like,
isn't that on him, though,
for the taking that question? To round out the story, Jason is released, ultimately. I have him on my show, the OG Takeout, when it was just a podcast, not a Monday through Friday streaming political show and podcast, which it is now. And he said, the next day, I got word about this. And it made all the difference in the world to me in my captivity.
Right.
That somebody had identified all of us, and that gave us tremendous hope. We believe that changed the dynamic. His own family, though, was deeply divided. I've met his family members, half of whom believe that question was a net benefit to Jason, half who believe it wasn't, and are pissed off at me that I had the audacity to ask it. Okay, I can live in that space.
Yeah.
That changed the world, not in a very big way, but for those people,
yeah,
it did. And I've always considered that one of my most proud accomplishments.
It's hard to ask a question of somebody knowing that they may interpret your question differently than it's intended. When we talk to Mike Schilt, you're talking to President Obama, and he thinks you may be implying that he's not caring about something. And I feel sometimes when we talk to Mike Schilt, he thinks we're implying that he's not focused enough on his team. He's not caring about enough about the wins and losses. I don't believe that. I believe truly that Mike Schilt is 100% committed to the San Diego Padres, doing everything he can to win games. Now, is he going to make mistakes, bad decisions? Of course, because that's part of sports. You're going to do that. I'm not trying to imply that when I ask, why are you still, why are you still batting Luis Arraez in the second spot? It's not also, is it because you're a moron? It's not. I know that he's got reasons for it, but I don't know how he's going to react to that question when we ask him.
Yeah, no, of course, you know exactly how he's going to react to that question. Yeah. I mean, that's therein lies the problem of every Thursday night before the Schilt interview. It used to be worse. Last year it was worse. I mean, I had a full blown anxiety attack before one of them, full blown. And I don't get them. I don't get panic attacks very often anymore. My mental health in 25 is infinitely better than it was in 24. Infinitely, double, triple. Mm-hmm. A lot of hard work put into that. A lot of hard work. A lot of looking in the mirror.
Yeah.
A lot of talking it through. 24, I was like, I had the fucking garbage can at my feet. Called Paulie one day, shaking up. Because I was so panicked about this interview. For what? Because some guy on Twitter is going to call me soft.
Go banging on you. Yeah.
Go banging on you a little bit. And I still, you still get it every now and then. It bothers me way less. Bothers me way less. You want to do a good job. You want to deliver for the fans. But what they want is the fisticuffs, the screaming at each other, calling him an idiot, him calling you an idiot. They want that. And I'm not the right guy to give it to him. Neither is Ben. Neither is Paul. We're not that show. I've never liked that in particular. Like, people will say, oh, man, in New York, Aaron Boone. And I'm like, they let that fucking dude off the hook all the time. What are you talking about? Like, what I'm not seeing is you're an idiot. You don't manage this team right. Like, again, it's a hard line to skirt, Major, thinking to yourself, I know they know more than I do. I know I don't know the full story. And I know that they don't have to tell me the full story, nor should they.
Right.
But I still have to ask the question. What they do with it is on them. I love that. I will remember that moving forward. I just got to ask the question.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Street Easy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie. But since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let StreetEasy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. StreetEasy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Game day or any day, your fit says it all. Hit up MLBShop.com for the latest jerseys, caps, hoodies, and accessories to keep you in the game all year long. Rep your team, rep your city, rep yourself. Gear up and game on at MLBShop.com, the official online shop of Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
There are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great. But it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going. Whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby.
Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
That's all you can do is put together the best question, maintain a dialogue, because in the end, you and Ben, Paul, myself, all we are is conduits from one locus of information to a consuming public.
Yeah.
That's all we are. And the best way to maintain not only that conduit as wide open, as wide as it can be, keep the person that you're talking to and the audience you're serving receiving the maximum amount of flow between the two. The audience, the fans, will do with it what they want. They will always find something to fault within the person asking the question, because there's never a perfect question.
And the person answering.
There's never a perfect interview. But we do this all the time. I don't know what it's like to be a software engineer. I don't know what it's like to be a plumber. I don't know what it's like to be a roofer. There are complications and hassles in that job. I don't pretend to know. But lots of people pretend they know what we do. They pretend they know what we do.
That's it.
And they don't. And that's not an attack. It's just a reality.
Oh, I'm attacking. I'm fully attacking you.
But you and Mike Schoen feels the same way.
Because this is the couch, and because you mentioned your mental health, I'll just go through a little bit of my personal background. So I had a very, very domineering father. Father who I would never get in his face ever. I won't say I lived in terror of my father, but I was very intimidated by my father all the time. I'm named after my father.
Was it volume? Was it message? Was it?
He had a very explosive temper that would erupt unpredictably frequently.
Yeah.
And so there was a very eggshell quality to my childhood, so much so that my father was a big smoker. And this being the 60s and 70s, he had a Zippo lighter. And a Zippo lighter, for anyone who's been around one, has a very distinctive click.
Oh, yeah.
As a child, I learned at a very early age to read that click. Soft click, and my dad was pretty mellow. Snap, I knew that the volcano was anywhere around at any moment. So the therapeutic point of all this is I never asked my father a hard question, but I've asked the father of our country lots of hard questions. I took that courage that I never had as a child, and I took it into a different space.
How did you get to that point? That's the thing, is like a lot of people have similar back. My kids will probably be telling the same story in 20 years, you know? How do you get from, because that's the thing I want to instill in them the most is to be confident, you know, be confident. Right. And don't be the, you know, it's funny. My son is 7. You see him on the baseball field and he's confident and he's pointing and he's demonstrative. And he's got a little swagger and a little attitude. Mm-hmm. You get him in the classroom and he's, you know, and it's like, you're two totally different people.
Right.
How did you get from reading the click of the Zippo to asking the president of the United States a hard question?
So that was the sort of harder side of my life with my father. The upside of it was highly intellectual. We never had the TV on during dinner. We had family conversation. He was a rigorous questioner. We had lots of back and forth. He wanted us to keep up with him intellectually. He took great pride in photography, jazz, literature.
Nice.
We were all sort of pulled in that direction. That was the upside of it, for sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of benefit there. A lot.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
Tremendous amount. And quite honestly, at age 5, I wore my first pair of glasses, and I had the name Major. That made me a very striking oddity from the moment I was in public school.
Yeah.
So when you're a striking oddity, you better figure out how to deal with that oddity factor. How do you explain your name? How do you explain the funny glasses that nobody else has?
Yeah.
And back in the 60s, we didn't have designer children's glasses. They were black rim, nerdy, dumb,
thick.
Thick,
yeah.
Yes.
Like a secret service agent. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I've got these really repellent glasses and the name like Major. And so you have to figure out how to sort of represent yourself.
Yes.
In real time. So that helped. And once I figured out that I wanted to be a reporter, which I figured out about age 13, I just got was very, very directly focused on that. And you build up confidence because you realize if you don't have that confidence, you're never going to get to that next chance.
Did you project it or did you actually have it?
I projected.
Because I project it.
I project
it. I don't actually have it.
I don't have it either. Any. And I was never, as an athlete, I was never a swaggy athlete because I never was good enough to be a swaggy athlete.
Never.
I played the game. I liked being around guys who had swagger. Yes. I never understood quite that secret sauce of swagger.
Yes.
It was always a mystery to me, but I knew they had it and I knew I didn't have it. But when you get to my level of journalism, that's kind of a show. That's kind of a, like a mutual respect thing. Like everyone who makes the major leagues has a baseline of respect. Correct. You're here.
You made it.
You've got a jersey. Your name's there. One game, 1,000 games, you're here. You've made it. There's that. And then there are levels of success there. And as anyone in any enterprise knows, whether it's being a lawyer, being a banker, a musician, whatever, the higher you go, the thinner the air. You've got to learn to breathe better when the air's thinner.
Such a good point.
Got to learn to breathe better when the air is thinner. And when your heart's racing faster and the pressure is higher, you still have to learn how to breathe better when the air is thinner and the pressure is higher.
Brilliant.
You said at age 13, you kind of knew you wanted to be
a
reporter. What drew you to that? Because I knew probably at age 13, I wanted to be a sportscaster. And I think I saw what, you know, Jerry Coleman would do calling games and I would listen and it was just, I just loved the idea of being a sportscaster. I love sports, so I wanted to be able to talk about sports. And I think I found not necessarily the journalism or the reporting part fascinating, but certainly the connection to being part of a team that I could never make in a million years with my athletic ability, that was a way that I could be a part of it, I thought. So that's what drew me to it. What drew you to it at age 13?
So let's just do the math. I'm born in August of 1962. So by age 13, it's 1975. Just scan the history in America from 1962 to 1975. It's pretty heavy, especially if you start in 1968, when I'm 6 years old, and I'm beginning to become aware that there's a newspaper that's dropped. Actually, there were two newspapers dropped on our front door, the Union Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, and three magazines. My parents had very upwardly mobile, middle-class aspirations, so they wanted us to be aware of the outside world, probably a little bit more than most of the neighbors we had in Kearney Mesa. So we got two newspapers and not just Time, not just Newsweek, but Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report, all three.
Yeah.
And Sports Illustrated to throw in there. So I was just immersed in this news environment and a lot of things were happening. I had two cousins who were in Vietnam. Mm. I remember making care packages for them. So the Vietnam War was not an abstraction. It wasn't an abstraction in most American homes, but in ours, it was a very big deal. And watching the news every night about Vietnam was something that was a very big part of my childhood, not to mention all the other things that happened in 68, 69, go up to the Nixon reelection in 72, first presidential campaign I was sort of aware of, and then Watergate, and then the resignation, and then Gerald Ford, and all of that. And I just thought, this is something that endlessly fascinates me. I can never get enough of it on television or in printed form. Could I ever do this?
Right.
And it was a ludicrous idea as a public school kid in San Diego. Ludicrous.
Why?
Because most of the people at the time doing that work were not from public schools in San Diego. They were from elite schools on the East Coast. And the idea, or they had people in their families who did this work. Nobody in my family, very few people in my family had gone to college, point one. Point two, none of them had ever been a journalist or a writer or aspired in that direction. I mean, these were just ludicrous ideas for someone who was not a very good speller, a terrible speller in middle school, middling student, not exceptional at any level. There just wasn't any putty there to make any kind of pottery out of. Nothing. There was just nothing except a desire.
Yeah.
A desire to try to get to a different place. And the first big decision of that was to become the editor of my school newspaper, the front page editor, not the entire editor. And I was on the yearbook. Then the next big decision was listening to my yearbook advisor, who said you should go to the University of Missouri, number one school of journalism in the country. And I did. And I got there, and that was of middling quality until I sort of got my legs underneath me. Then I became the most conspicuous failure of my graduating class at the University of Missouri, the most conspicuous failure in 1984, May of 1984. Number one school of journalism in the country. Everyone gets a job. Everyone graduates with a job that's already locked and loaded. It's already in. You already baked the cake. It's all baked for you. And that was true of everyone in my graduating class, except me.
Wow.
I was the only one who walked across stage, the only one in my class who did not have a job. My classmates had jobs at the San Jose Mercury News, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Kansas City Star, Columbia Daily Tribune, New York Times, LA Times, Dallas Morning News, Dallas Times Herald, Miami Herald, Philly Inquirer, Wall Street Journal, nothing.
What the fuck happened?
Said, were you rejected? Were you applying and getting rejected?
67 rejection letters.
Holy shit, man.
Oh, my God.
Holy shit.
I have a file that I've kept with me since then.
Oh, you're like
all me. All 67 letters.
You're like me.
From newspapers as large as the Los Angeles Times and as small as the La Crosse, Wisconsin Tribune.
They all said no.
All said no.
And you keep them. Do you go through them? Like I go through
I don't go through them. I don't go through them, but I've kept them. I've never gotten rid of them because I want to remind myself that there was a time when I thought my career was over before it began.
Before it started.
Very quick story. So we're 4 weeks before graduation. One newspaper is coming through for one final recruiting trip, the Dallas Times Herald, which was at the time in 1984, locked in a major newspaper battle.
Oh, yeah.
People don't even know what I'm talking about, but they were very big.
Yeah.
The Times Herald, the Morning News.
Yep.
And both papers were hiring wildly to expand their suburban editions. So the Times Herald came up. They had four openings. There were five of us left. And everyone knew. Everyone knew who the five were. And everyone knew the Times Herald came up with four openings. And then everyone knew who got the four jobs. Holy and I was out.
Holy shit, man.
Yeah.
I had a rough patch many years ago before I met Ben and Paul and started this juggernaut of a show. Where my son was about to be born, I'd gotten out of radio. I didn't really want to. Kind of did it out of a sense of loyalty to somebody else. That friendship fizzled soon after. And I was like, I have made a tremendous mistake. I got to right the wrongs. And I can vividly remember begging for a job, an opportunity, any shift. And I saved those emails, and they all turned me down. None of those guys are in radio anymore at all. They're out of radio. They don't make decisions in radio. And I go back through them once a year, and I read them, and it kind of reinvigorates me.
Every December, when Paulie we're off knows. For a couple of weeks, Woods will forward us. Like, we'll wake up and have, like, three or four forwarded emails from, 2017 or 2018.
Mm-hmm. Where I'm begging
for a job. Where he's just like, look at what we fucking did, guys. Yeah, like look what they thought, and look at what we've done, 7 years later. And it's kind of an annual, like, cleaning out the inbox.
Right.
Well, and Woods will send them over. He saves those.
I go through them.
Yeah.
You know what I want to talk about? I find it so interesting, the parallel of like, so when you were, the world around you was what inspired you to become a reporter and become a journalist. And what it also inspired back then was the greatest influx of art, music, literature that maybe we've ever seen, at least in our country, right? As far as the United States goes, the people that were out there not taking any shit, writing the music about it, making the movies about it, things that matter, movies and art and music. They were so inspired. Now, we're in a very tumultuous time in our country right now. No one can deny that. The most divided I've ever seen our country in 50 years, by far.
Mm-hmm.
Not even close.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Street Easy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie, but since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let Street Easy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Game day or any day, your fit says it all. Hit up MLBShop.com for the latest jerseys, caps, hoodies, and accessories to keep you in the game all year long. Rep your team, rep your city, rep yourself. Gear up and game on at MLBShop.com, the official online shop of Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking, or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great, but it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going. Whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby, Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
What scares the shit out of me, it literally keeps me up at night, and it's why I jam art down my kids' throats, is because what I'm not seeing is that same inspiration. What are kids now at 13 inspired to be? Well, they're inspired to be TikTokers and Instagram influencers, and that's not art. That's not the art of our day. It's just not. The bands aren't the same. The music's
the art of this
not,
day.
But it's not. It's not art. It's so fleeting. It doesn't last. It's 30 seconds and you're done, right? Mm-hmm. Art stands the test of time. Music stands the test of time. Movies stand the test of time. You know, this, hey, here's me jumping on the field at Petco Park. Here's me. I saw a fucking kid the other day. I swear to God, I think it was fake. It had to be. Dropping a toaster in a bathtub that he was sitting in with water in it. And it's the second time he's done it. And I'm looking at this going, where... Whatever's happening, all the tumultuous things that are happening in our country, it's making people go the other way. They want to be silly,
right?
And not serious. Everyone's afraid to be bold, be fearless. Everyone's just kind of taking care of what they can right now. That's the difference for me. It's why I'm trying to teach my kids about the great music, the great artists, the great writers. Some of it falls on deaf ears. Some of it I can see seeping through. But therein lies the difference, man. That whole scene that you were living on a daily basis inspired you to go, I can change the world. I can do this.
Yeah,
and now I mean, it's different. And I know I'm generalizing. I know I am. I know there's probably a band somewhere that's looking at what's going on in the country and going, let's write a song that's going to change the world. Will it? Will it get played? Will a record company sign them? Probably not, because it doesn't have auto-tune. And it,
even the people that have, you know, that type of power, I guess, where they can influence, you know, a country. Like, I'm thinking, like, a new Taylor Swift song. She's not going to do that.
No.
She's not going to make an anti-America or any... because. And I'm just, she was the first person that popped to mind as far as music goes and their status in the world. But anybody that has any sort of celebrity status now, like they don't want to lose half their fan base or get canceled or anything like that.
I'm so glad that Neil Young and, you know, David Crosby and all the fearless, there's maybe four fearless artists left. Maybe. And Jason Isbell's one. James Fry's another one. He's an author. There, you know, P.T. Anderson, the filmmaker. I mean, there's maybe four fearless people left on the planet as far as the arts go.
you know, and that's John Mayer's not going to be like a new Bruce Springsteen, right, right. And like, I this mean, is going to be.
And growing up in that time, seeing the world inspire so many people and really help get people out of all the bullshit.
Right, but remember that inspiration was built on a very large steaming heap of pain.
100%. But that's what I'm saying is we are in a very large heaping steaming pile of pain in this country, and it's just I just see it getting worse instead of better, and I'm seeing people go the other way, running away from things, running towards the quick fix. I'm as guilty as the next. I spend 50 fucking hours a day on Twitter and stupid mm-hmm. shit, right? I'm as guilty as the next. I'm not out there trying to change the world, you know? I'm not fearless on my radio show. I'm scared to death. You know, it's I want to, I have a family. I got to protect my family. I need 401k and I need medical. So I'm preaching something that I'm not capable of doing.
Right.
But where are those great ones, you know? And I love that story from you because it did remind me of, you know, why so many people back then did what they did, you know, and you're a walking, talking example of somebody that was motivated and interested by changing the country, changing the world, changing how people see the world and telling the truth.
Yeah. Now, I would say this. What I've tried to accomplish as a journalist and what I've tried to bring in terms of a perspective to politics has been, for all the reasons you just laid out about where our society currently is, an abject failure.
Yeah.
The market share, the credibility of the people that I work around has never been lower.
Right.
I'm not personally responsible for that, but I'm lopped in with it.
Sure.
I'm identified with it. There's a large percentage of this audience that will probably consider me a mass media or legacy media hack.
Right.
A corporatist who works for CBS. Some would think I'm therefore an ideological leftist. I'm not immune to that idea, that perception. Of course, there was a time in my career when I was identified as an ideological rightist.
Right.
When I worked at Fox.
Right.
You know, and I've lived in both spaces where one audience thought I was much more fantastic than I actually was. And one part of the audience thought I was much stupider than I actually was. And then I've been on the other side of it, where the people who thought I was once stupid now think I'm brilliant. And the people who once I thought I was a great American patriot think I'm a traitor. And I've had those things said to me on my face.
Yeah.
And all I've ever tried to be is a journalist that does journalism where I did the journalism and brought something unique to the place I worked. When I was at Fox, I mostly covered Democrats. Why? Because Democrats would talk to me, and they wouldn't talk to very many other people from Fox. Now I'm at CBS, and I feel like I'm living a reverse of that life. Republicans will talk to me who won't talk to many other people at CBS. So I'm living the other side of that life. The continuity for me is anyone can talk to me because they know I know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
They know what I'm about. They know I'm not going to play games with them, and they know I'm about the audience. I've always been about the audience.
Not your personal agenda.
No, I don't have an agenda.
Right.
I don't want to be a star. I never tried to be a star. Yeah. I don't consider myself a star. I'm not a social media hound. I haven't posted on X in 9 or 10 months. Smart. And if you go to my profile, what has it always said from day one? This is a transmitter, not a receiver. I don't know you. You don't know me. We're never going to pretend we know each other. I'm not going to perform for you. I have a job to do, and I will do that job. You can scrutinize that job. You can hassle me about that job. You can tell your friends I'm an idiot or a hack. Fine. That will not touch me.
It's great perspective.
I will not be touched by it. You will not judge me. You can judge me on your own terms, but that judgment will not come to me.
Even if they're in your DMs, it's screaming into the void.
No, yeah.
How do you and your colleagues handle it? I've only worked at one television station, news station my whole life, but I watch daily my colleagues, my managers hold editorial meetings with a genuine amount of openness and honesty about trying to cover stories fairly. Like we have so many meetings about trying to be as fair as possible on every right. story, like checks and counterbalances to make sure that we are not trying to, you know, tip too far and just keep it fair all the time. And yet you still have people who accuse you of being fake and liars all the time. As if we, you know, they are trying so hard to keep agenda and politics out of it. And yet that's the main accusation. And I'm sure it must be 100 times worse.
It is
at the national level. But in your experience, you know, the people that you work with, you know, they care about just trying to be accurate and fair as much as possible in doing the news, like obsessively so in my experience.
Right.
And that's the only thing that we don't get credit for generally in the news media now.
Because everyone not only can be a critic, but unlike a bygone era when you were a critic on your couch or on your corner bar stool, you can be a multi-platform critic instantaneously. And you can pick apart anything I do or any one of my colleagues has done, point out four things that, because of the compression of time of the medium in which we operate, are not noted. Therefore, it feels biased to you in one way or the other. Plenty of people on the left believe corporate media is too soft and too safe. People on the right believe it's too soft and too safe because they can bring their own industrial complex of media criticism to their platform instantaneously. They have all their own archives. They have all their own footnotes. They have all their own things. You can become an industrialized media critic instantaneously and reach a very broad audience. And when I was growing up and there was CBS, ABC, and NBC, and some very large major newspapers and news magazines, they were the gatekeeper. That's the thing we all learned about in journalism school. They were the central funneling mechanism that took a vast array of information and funneled it down into a single source. And that provided two things. A marketplace that had fewer options. So you didn't go down a grocery aisle that had 42 brands of soup. You had 3 brands of soup. And you chose the soup you liked. It wasn't 42 or 422. That's one differentiator. The other is there wasn't a counter marketplace available to make money with ideologically shaped news. Social media has amplified that, but Fox and MSNBC started it. So you could have home team news. Now, I was not a home team news operator at Fox, again, because I covered the other side, because I was the only one in the newsroom they could confidently send out there and get Barack Obama to talk to. I interviewed Barack Obama 6 times when he ran for president. Jake Tapper at ABC interviewed him 3 times. That doesn't make me a better journalist than Jake Tapper, but at least I had the wherewithal for an entity like Fox to land big interviews with somebody like that, and nobody else at Fox could. So I had a utility there. But still, the network wrapped around me was a home team network, just as MSNBC became a home team network. So every interview is patty cake and pablumized, sort of.
I've pretty much had to deal with that my whole life. I was born in 1990.
Right.
And so as a teenager, call it, in the early to mid-2000s, the lines had already been drawn
and blurred
completely.
It was blurred between news 100%. And editorializing news.
Yes. It didn't matter.
And if we blurred them ourselves for market share.
Right. Yeah. It didn't matter if it was television, radio, like you knew the source and you knew the spin that would come with it. And so for me, at least as a young teenager, when I did try to, because I didn't care a whole lot about the world outside of, you know, girls and sports or whatever at 14. But when I did want to read more about a story, I chose to read rather than go to a news outlet and watch a story on whether it was Hurricane Katrina or, you know, the financial crisis of the 2008. Like, by reading it, whether, you know, and you had to be careful of your sources as well, whether it's Yahoo News or Fox News or CNN, like you had to be aware of the source. But for whatever reason, for me, reading it to myself, I put it in my own voice and I was able to comprehend the information my way rather than, you know, like you said, if you go to Fox News, they're going to tell it with their spin. If you go to MSNBC, you're going to get it with their spin. I kind of just wanted the facts, and that's been increasingly more difficult to find over the years.
It has been, and there's a long-running argumentation over what a fact is.
Yes.
What is a fact?
What is a fact?
Right.
Who has it? Who's the fact bureau? we're now in a situation where the president of the United States says a fact from a government agency isn't a fact.
Right.
If it disagrees with his perspective, it's not a fact anymore.
Right.
Just isn't.
Right. Makes it hard to navigate.
Makes it hard to navigate. And look, part of the revolution of social media is you can be the director of your own story.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And when you internalize that power of being the director of your own story, you get to satisfy yourself every time. The cut is always the way you want it.
Yep.
Your life is always the director's cut. Well, that makes you pretty inflexible and intolerant about things that don't fit within the director's cut perspective outwardly.
Correct.
Your inward is always cut to your satisfaction. It is always your story. It is always your perfection, how you want to portray it. That kind of distorts your own personal reality, I would observe, but it also distorts your ability to absorb real reality out there. And it makes you, I believe, less patient and less tolerant of things that don't fit your own director's cut.
No doubt. There's no doubt. I mean, it's, you know, it's the same thing. It's baseball is the one thing I admire about you too, is that, you know, you haven't lost your zeal for it. When I worked in music radio, I quickly lost my zeal. Now music is my entire life. When I'm not here, I have my AirPods in. When I'm at home and I need to remember, my kids are talking to me, I need to take this out, because it's so important to me. It soothes me. It fires me up. It motivates me. It keeps me awake. It keeps me engaged, at least in my own brain. And you know, when I started working in music radio, I didn't like the direction of music. So it was hard to get on every day and be like, fuck yeah, man,
right,
this band, great. And I would constantly butt heads with my program director. Why did we add this? This fucking sucks. This doesn't make any sense in this market. This is not going to work. Well, it's testing well in New York. It's testing well in LA. And it's like, but we're different. We're different here. But you haven't lost your zeal for the arena. And I feel the same way. Like Ben and Woods, you get a little in the weeds about baseball, but it will never take away my love for the game. My
right.
love for the game will always be there. And it's expressed now more through Little League, Adult League, Fantasy Camp, playing the game, coaching the game, being around the game. I love the Major League game, obviously, but like it hasn't taken away from that. I'll be honest, I get bored with the minutia of it, of, all right, in the third inning, he did it. Why did he do this? It gets fucking old and it's tired because baseball is not meant to be viewed like a football season.
Right.
And we started doing that after when COVID hit and we had a 60-game season. Every game was a fucking sprint, and every game you're on meth.
Right.
I was on meth. No. I was like methed out that whole season, just like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And now we got 102 more games, and every game is like, fucking fire him, and fucking you guys suck, and you guys are pussies, and you're like, holy shit, it's a whole new generation of fan, which is great. But they're consuming it in a really weird way that has actually changed the way that I consume it. Now I find myself being more, and it's like, let's see how we do in the series or the next 10 games, right?
The best team this season will lose 60 or more games.
Correct.
The worst team will lose 60 or more games and win 60. Now the Rockies may not win 60.
They may not get to 60.
But most bad teams,
you can almost bank it.
Right. So 60, okay, that's 120. What does that leave?
42. Just have a fucking 42 game season at this point. My God.
But you landed on something super important. You cannot be a baseball fan who thinks like a football fan.
It's so pervasive though, Major. It's so pervasive. I'm guilty of it. We are all guilty of it.
My wife has a great phrase about this. Football is event. Baseball is a pattern.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people in San Diego, Padres fans, new Padres fans, maybe came over and started watching and investing more time in the San Diego Padres after the Chargers left.
Right.
Coincidentally, it was like 2 years later that the Padres started to get really good.
Yep.
Or at least on everyone else's radar. With Fernando, with signing Manny. I mean, hell, we were excited about Chris Paddock making the fucking roster in 2019. Yeah.
Sheriff,
but like the Chargers left. The Padres were not only the only team in town, but they became relevant on a national level. And then they started winning a little bit.
And it's fucked with everyone.
And I'd agree 100% with that.
It's fucked with people so bad. And it makes our job, it makes it difficult. Because we had the thing, Ben had something personal with his life last week. I was home visiting my father with cancer. I couldn't have given less of a shit about what happened in those games.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have. Right. I tried. I watched three innings and I fell asleep. And yeah. I couldn't, my body, my mind, I couldn't bring myself to give a fuck about them. Ben was the same way. Ben missed a Dodger game, you know, because he was in the ER with the Sun.
Yeah, yeah.
So who gives a shit about the Dodgers and Padres, right?
Right.
But it will never take away my love fully for the actual game of baseball. We don't appreciate enough, myself included, some of the great feats that we see on a nightly basis. Luis Arraez is a perfect example. You know, we are picking apart his OBP. I am as guilty as the next guy. I don't think he should be in the two. I think he should be in the lineup. But we don't appreciate how hard it is to have 140 hits
right.
at the big league level. It's really fucking hard. You know, challenge you to go hit in the 70-mile-an-hour cage at Boomers today and see how you do. And so we have lost a lot of the respect for the players. They have become units. They have become machines that we expect greatness from every single time. We don't factor in the human enough. And when we bring it up, that makes us soft. If you bring up the travel, if you bring now, I get it. They're millionaires, man. These guys are set. They're great. It's great. There's a reason they make that much money, though, because it's really fucking hard and it's really rare to be able to do what they do. They're the greatest 1% of the 1% of the 1% that can do what they do. And it's the hard part about our job is trying to look at it holistically more than this is his OBP, this is his ERA, this is his blown saves, figure it out, win a World Series. You know, honestly, like that part of the game a little bit has been ruined for me. We all need to, and everybody I think needs to try to remember the beauty of the game, the ballet aspect of it, the double play that you couldn't, if you took three of your buddies out to a field,
right,
put them at second, short, and first, hit the same ball in the same spot, I'll give you 100 chances. You can't make it look like they do.
100 miles an hour off the bat.
Right. No. 105 off the bat.
No.
Backhand in the hole, jump throw to second base, the pivot, guy bearing down on it. You make a throw to the first baseman's chest. You couldn't fucking do it.
No.
In 100 tries.
No.
And
you couldn't do it in 1,000 tries.
And that's what we've just become conditioned to the machine, the numbers.
I could not get a base hit off a single A pitcher.
No.
There's no way.
No chance. No chance.
He had 100 at bats, and he'd strike you out 100 times.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or he'd fucking dot you on the third pitch, and you'd be done.
Yeah. Right.
That'd be it.
Yes.
Yep.
I'd rather hit off a big leaguer than a single A pitcher, because at least those guys know where the fuck it's going.
Right.
At the big league level. You know. Yeah.
All right. You got Mason Miller tomorrow.
Yeah. Right. 104. Like.
Right.
There's just no way.
And a killer slider. No,
and we look at it, and you're like, you weren't perfect. You suck, and you suck for putting him in, and you're terrible. It gets overwhelming at times. So this has been a long-winded way of just saying, like, you know, you got to take some of that with a grain of salt. Try to remember the beauty of the art form that is baseball. The ability to be able to rear back and throw 100 miles an hour, the ability to be able to stand in front of a ground ball at 106 miles an hour. No problem. Just I'm standing right here.
Right.
And I'm going to, if I miss it or he gets a funky hop, I'm wearing it and I'm going to make the throw. I'm going to take the out. It is so goddamn hard. You can't even wrap your head around at that level. And I want to mention this too, when it comes to the manager, you know, the management for the world's slowest game, there is nothing on the planet that speeds up faster than a baseball game on you. If you're managing at any level, and I manage T-ball, I manage Little League, and I manage Adult League. That's the highest I've ever managed. The game gets so fucking fast on you.
Right.
You can't even imagine. You're like, what just happened? Oh, shit. I didn't get him ready. He's not ready to throw. And I need to go to the, so much goes on. And
by the time he gets ready, three runs are scored.
Right. And it is this slow, languid game, but get in a dugout at any level, Little League.
Right.
You know, and you're like, oh my God, this fucking game is speeding up on me really fast. The great ones can slow it down and know, have all the information and make informed decisions. We all need to, I think, do a better job at remembering that. And really why we started watching this game.
Right. And for me, I watch a lot of baseball and I watch a lot of golf because both deal with public failure
so much
on a regular basis. And I don't know about the three of you, but this is kind of a cliche in life, but it's certainly been true for me. I have gained more, learned more, built more atop of my failures 100%. Than my successes.
100%. Oh, yeah. Not even close. We've talked about it before. Success for this program has been the worst thing that's ever happened to me personally. The worst thing. And it's not because, oh, you're making more money and, oh, more people know you. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about getting up there and being like, all right, now what?
Right.
Fuck, how did we get here?
Right.
The climb was always my favorite part. It's my absolute favorite part. The grind, the struggle, the competition, the we're here to kill and maim, and we're going to be the best. And then you get to the top, and you're like, all right,
yeah.
What now? Like, well, how do we stay relevant? It's been the worst thing that's ever happened. Really? Right. Like, I'd rather be in seventh place still climbing to first right now. The ratings bonuses are nice. They're great. But it's that climb that keeps me at my best.
So
this is when I'm like, what do? We got to do something, right?
Right.
And it's such a bad place to live.
So the American businessman who saved the Padres, Ray Kroc, had a saying, the day you ripen is the day you begin to rot.
100%, man. 100%. How do you stay in that, state?
Constant grow. 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 Whatever you're doing, keep growing. Because the day you ripen is when you start to rot.
On that note, ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for the great Major Garrett.
That was
incredible.
Unbelievable.
This was off
first guest on this short-lived.
First guest. And
oh, really?
Imagine trying to top that, whoever the next guest will be.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, Pimp Lord, eat your heart out, buddy. All right? We love the Pimp Lord podcast. We're big fans. We thank you guys for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed it. And we will be back very soon. We're going to go eat some barbecue now.
We are?
Yeah, we're forced.
Barbecue,
we've been forced to eat barbecue.
Thank you, guys. Odyssey.
Thank you, guys.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
A message from a former New Yorker, presented by StreetEasy.
We left Brooklyn Heights in 2021, and we miss it. We went from sharing a neighborhood with a few celebrities to sharing a neighborhood with my wife's parents.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, StreetEasy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. StreetEasy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Game day or any day, your fit says it all. Hit up MLBShop.com for the latest jerseys, caps, hoodies, and accessories to keep you in the game all year long. Rep your team, rep your city, rep yourself. Gear up and game on at MLBShop.com, the official online shop of Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking, or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great, but it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters, and keeps the journey of exploration going. Whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby, Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.